الأجل يوسف زهراء، الأجل يوسف زهراء، الأجل يوسف زهراء.
من الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في العرضين، صاحب العصر والزمان، خليفة الرحمن، إمام الإنس والجان، ولعن الله أعداءهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الذين آمنوا والذين هاجروا وجاهدوا في سبيل الله أولئك يرجون رحمة الله والله غفور رحيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم. صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد.
شهيد and شاهد. The martyr and the witness has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 7. As we do every single night, a little bit of a recap for those who are new, just so we're on the same page moving forward. Our attempt with this topic has been to understand Imam Hussein's philosophy and him being the shaheed and us being the witness, to understand our responsibility during these difficult times, and to understand Imam Hussein's mission, his philosophy, his ideology, the reason why he did what he did with so much certainty on the day of Ashura, is first essential for us to first understand what our responsibility is. And we have now entered the second portion of our 9-day series that talks about our responsibility during this day and age towards Imam Hussein's mission. 2 nights ago, we talked about the importance of grieving over this mission. We talked about the importance of this system of azadari that we have, and how every component of it, from the intellectual discussions on this minbar to the emotional delivery of our grief in the form of matam and masaib, are equally as important. All of this is ibadat. Every single form of it is a devotion for us to Imam Hussein, is a gift to Imam Hussein. Yesterday we talked about another responsibility we have towards Imam Hussein's mission, and of course that being following the Sharia, that same Sharia that he left his house in Medina to uphold, to protect, to preserve. We talked about how the Sharia is a gift from Allah, a grace from Allah, his lutf and him being latif. We talked about that yesterday, the philosophy behind it as well. And tonight, we talk a little bit about hijrat, about migration. You see, migration or hijrat has many different forms to it. And usually, when we hear the word hijrat or migration, we think about a physical migration from one geographical location to another. Or, as I mentioned, from one country to another. And those of our respective adults who left their countries in the east to come to the west, that's their migration. However, the ayat I read for you in the khutbah, it talks about 3 different groups of people. The Ahle Iman, the Ahle Hijrat, the Ahle Jihad. These 3 individuals are individuals, أُولَٰئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ. There are people who should have hope in the mercy of Allah. What hijrat here is the Quran talking about? We know that Imam Hussein's mission had nothing to do with power or government or greed or money or some sort of fame in this world. He, every step of the way in his journey, he would give a khutbah, a sermon, a reminder why I'm doing what I'm doing. And to summarize it, he would talk about the idea that, look, this nation of ours, the Islamic deen of ours, has lost its path from my nana's deen, from my grandfather's deen, so much so that I am now leaving the comforts of Medina to once again reform them back onto the path of my grandfather's deen. They've deviated. They're off the path. You have a khalifa right now in the name of Yazid who's actually telling individuals this whole Medina, Risalat, Prophethood, Ahlul Bayt show that was put on was just that, it's a show. There's no wahi coming down on some man. There's no infallible family. All of it was some sort of a circus they put on to gain a little bit of shu'rat, a little bit of fame. When the Khalifa of Islam has this ideology, how far are they, of course, from the actual path of Islam and Muhammad? Very far. He went out for Islah, he went out for reform, he went out to once again introduce this idea that these individuals are not what my grandfather's deen is about. This is what my grandfather's deen is about. And this has happened several times in history. Before this also, his father, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam. I don't like these types of salawat, please. I'm better than that. This salawat is Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. When the Ummah came begging and knocking on the door of Amir al-Mu'mineen after the death of Uthman, it said, now we don't see anybody else who's capable of leading us, but you, Amir al-Mu'mineen. After many, many times of Ali saying, look, you know, you're better off without me, you're better off without me, when he finally accepts, he says one sentence to them. He says, I am a rajulun fa'al, I'm a man of action. I will do exactly what needs to be done to resurrect the Quran and the Sunnah. Meaning what? At that moment, the fact that he had to say that means that the nation had fallen away from the Quran and the Sunnah of the Ahlul Bayt. Again, the nation comes in the time of Yazid. Again, Imam Hussein, his son, comes out and says, I am here for nothing else but the Islah of the Ummah of my grandfather. Okay? And history again repeats itself today as well. We have the likes of Nusra and Daesh, as Brother Hassan had said beautifully in his poem, mashallah. Where this is now the face of Islam, unfortunately. And once again, the need is for us to bring that back on to the path. But first, we have to go through a migration. So this hijrah that the Quran talks about is not just a physical one. This hijrah is of the soul as well. That if the physical hijrah, if a physical migration is from one country to another, a spiritual hijrah migration is from one state of your nafs to another state of your nafs. If you're leaving the comfort of your family and your friends and your language and your culture in one country and flying over the ocean onto another country, and that's also considered a migration, then in this migration of the soul, you're leaving behind your old habits, your sins, all those mistakes you've made, and you're going one notch higher in the eyes of Allah. That's why the three groups again, الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ حَاجَرُوا وَجَاهَدُوا Iman, Hijrat, Jihad. All three are necessary if we expect the mercy of Allah. Where? Fi sabilillah, the ayah says, on the path of Allah. What is that migration? It's a migration from mawjood to matlub, meaning what? From the level of is to the level of should be. Let me say it one more time. Mawjood is to exist. We all exist. We're all here, we're all present. Walking, talking, eating, sleeping, everything. There are those who have lowered this life and this world to be just that. Sleep, eat, work, repeat. Sleep, eat, work, repeat. That's mawjood. That is what Islam wants from us, is something a little bit more. A mawjood state to a matlub state. Matlub means a desired state of existence. I'll give you one small example from history. The night of migration. The night of migration of the Holy Prophet from Mecca to Medina, very famous in history, as all of you should know and do know, I'm sure. When the tribes inside Mecca could not stop the mission of the Holy Prophet. They tried everything. They approached a man and said, look, what do you want? You want money? You want women? You want property? You want the government? You want power? What do you want? We'll give you everything. Just stop preaching this God and Tawheed thing. You're killing our business and you're killing our faith. Because the idols back then were a source of income and a source of faith as well. They would buy and sell. Mecca was the hub of trading idols. That's what famously the Holy Prophet said. You put the sun in the right hand, the moon in the left, I won't accept your deal. Goes to Abu Talib and says, look, explain to your nephew to stop preaching this altogether. Abu Talib says, I can't do that. I got his back. I can't do it. Wherever he goes, I go. They went, then they resorted to character assassination. He is a sahir, he's a magician. He's majnun, na'udhu billah, he's a lunatic. He's crazy. They pick up false hadiths about the Holy Prophet. Like the one, of course, that we have sometimes in our other books that talk about the fact when the first wahi came down, the Prophet of Allah was so confused that his wife, Bibi Khadija, took him to her uncle. Uncle was a Christian priest. He informed the Holy Prophet, by the way, you're the last prophet of God. He says, whoo, thank God. I thought something was wrong with me. This is how the prophethood was presented to us in some of our books, unfortunately. When all of that didn't work, when the mission of Islam kept growing, kept growing, kept growing, the plan was again to do what? To kill the man. No other choice. We tried everything. We threw feces at him. We threw garbage at him. We threw him outside of Mecca for 3 years in Shibba Abu Talib. We tortured his followers. We put sanctions upon sanctions, economic sanctions, social sanctions, everything we could possibly do to isolate them, to make them surrender, but nothing works whatsoever. Sanctions didn't work back then, sanctions don't work today either. Yeah. They don't. Yes.
Muhammad wa Ali, Muhammad wa Ajil
Farajum. I love history. It has a beautiful way of a mirror reflecting today and yesterday. Khair. What happens then? Kill the man. What do you do? One tribe can't kill Muhammad because they are fearful of Abu Talib's tribe. Abu Talib's tribe back then, for lack of a better comparison, was the mafia. They were the boys. Don't touch them. Untouchables. Don't go near them. Don't look at them the wrong way. Don't walk hard around them. Don't grow a limp around them. Nothing. They run this place. So they decide to come together. One person from each tribe goes on the night, and together you are there and you kill the Prophet of Allah. That way, not one tribe is blamed for the death of the Holy Prophet. Okay? Jibreel comes down and tells the Holy Prophet of this plot to assassinate him. All the tribes When by what? He approached the Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali, this is the plan they have against me. Are you able to sleep in my bed tonight? The Holy Prophet trusted Amir al-Mu'mineen to the point where Ali only asked him one question. This is very famous history, by the way. I'm sure my others have heard this 1,000 times. That if by sleeping in your bed will you be saved? Will Risala to be saved? Will prophethood be saved? Will your mission continue? Yes, it will. If I'll sleep, no problem. We see the same tarbiyat, same upbringing in his son Imam Hussain, where he says, if it requires that the swords come and mutilate my body for my grandfather's deen to be saved, then bring the swords on. Imam Ali sleeps in the bed. The Prophet leaves for that migration. We believe that that night there was only one migration. There wasn't. There were two migrations. One migration was physical. A man left Mecca towards Medina. And one migration was spiritual. A man left from one level of iman to another level of iman. How? By selling his soul for the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa
ta'ala.
So our migrations are of different categories. The one that is needed today is not for you to up and leave physically anywhere else. Stay where you are. But what's needed is for you to migrate spiritually, to go up one level. From is to, say it with me, should be. From a mawjood state to a matlub state. From you walking and talking and using your limbs to you being an individual who is seeking the pleasure of Allah wherever you go. Is to should be. Is to should be. Mawjood to matlub. Then we can expect the mercy of Allah. When the mercy of Allah is upon us, our soul begins to cleanse itself and this journey continues upward. How do we do that? One very important ingredient tonight that I want to talk about in the wake of this migration is one thing that Imam Hussein time and time again talked about, that I am going for amal bil ma'roof and nahi an al-munkar. If we've identified, and we should identify this, that we need to go through this migration constantly, we should also identify that we can't do this alone. See, a growing trend right now that's happening, that's a little bit of a cause of concern for me, is that the deen of Islam is now becoming a very infiradi deen, a personal religion, where everyone's spirituality, everyone's journey towards Allah is their own journey. What's happening around them is not a concern for them. Who is at what level? I don't care. It could be the person beside me, my spouse and my kids. It could be my community. It could be my fellow Arab or Palestinian or Iraqi on that side of the ocean. I don't care. I have to focus on my own path. Islam to them has been a very individual Islam. We should know that Islam came about to not only purify the individual, but purify the nation as well. If there is a component of the deen that's infiradi, individual, there's a component of the deen that's ijtima'i as well, social. And the growth of the social Islam cannot happen without the individual Islam. Very easy. A corrupt community is comprised of corrupt individuals. A pious community is comprised of pious individuals. It is a wajibat of ours. It's a furu of our deen. My young kids in the audience, you guys have learned in Sunday school that there are 10 furu'idin. One is Amr bin Ma'ruf, another is Nahy bin Munkar. But sometimes when it comes to this obligation specifically, we have drowned ourselves in the Western philosophy of what? To each his own. Mind your own business. No one's asking you. I didn't ask you to speak. I didn't ask for your opinion. I don't need you to come and tell me what I'm doing wrong, what I'm doing right. On the flip side, you see somebody drowning in the ocean, you're like, wow, sucks to be you. Thank God I know how to swim. And you walk away. You have the lifeguard on, you have all the tools to save yourself. A person that you know is drowning? No. Come on, man. I have a tough enough time saving myself. You want me to spend a little bit of energy saving him as well? Come on. I have a tough enough time keeping my grave lit up. You want me to light up that grave as well? I don't have time for that. I don't have the energy. I don't have the passion for it. He should have done his homework. He should have done this job. It's his fault, not my fault. Blah, blah, blah. We fall into the trap of the individual, not of the family atmosphere. Where the Holy Prophet time and time again pounds this point home that where you have pain in a certain portion of the body, the other portions of that body goes and rescues that portion from its pain. And that's how my ummah is. If one area is bleeding, you go and you stop the bleeding in that portion of the ummah. Whether you are Arab or you're not Arab, whether you are Palestinian or you're not Palestinian, whether you are Pakistani or you are not Pakistani, has nothing to do with that. It's a forgotten obligation. You simply don't talk to each other about it. We know people, we see people, they're going down the wrong path. We can sit there and tell this person, 5 years from now, you're going to end up either in jail, you end up OD'd, you end up somewhere else. You can literally see it happening. Don't stop it. And there are several reasons for that. Look at this hadith by our Holy Prophet Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad ajjal farajah.
A very famous hadith about a boat. He says, I want you to imagine you are in a boat with your fellow boat people. And you are in the middle of the ocean. And you see one individual take an axe and go to the corner of the boat and begin to chop a hole in the boat. Right? You have two choices. You go and say, oh, that's interesting. He's making a hole in the boat. Okay, and you walk away. Or you can say, look, brother, with all due respect, stop doing this. If that hole gets bigger, you're going to sink, I'm going to sink. He says the boat is Islam and we are Muslims inside that boat. If somebody is doing something wrong to place a hole in that boat will sink, you'll sink along with it. So your job is to do what? To make sure the boat is protected, preserved, so it will get you to your destination. And that's what you do. What is the problem today? Especially amongst our youth. You guys, you know where your friends are going. You know where your siblings are going. You know where your cousins are going. You follow them on social media. You see where they're living their life. You see they're making grave mistakes. You know their parents are clueless. But you know exactly how they're living their life. They sometimes even confide inside of you. But yet you're quiet. And then when it's too late, and the parents know, and they're beating their head, and they ask you, Ali, did you know? Hussein, did you know it's going to happen? And if you say, yes, I knew, they'll hang you. How could you not have told us? You could have done something to save this from happening, to avoid this, prevent this from happening. Why do we do it? Number one, We are fearful of being that person. There's something in the world of corporate America, an experiment they started years ago, called groupthink. If you Google it, you'll find out what that is. Not right now, do it at home. Okay. Your phone should be shut off anyways. Yeah, right. I'm taking notes, Alana. I'm sure you are. Yes. Yeah. The whole idea behind this experiment was to see who would conform and who would not conform in a business atmosphere. Who's a team leader and who's just a follower? Who would recognize that they're going off the path and grab it and pull it back, and who would just go along with whatever the herd is doing? So they would put certain team members inside certain situations and watch them, examine them, to see exactly, did anyone speak out, anyone say anything, anyone go against the grain to say, look guys, this is not right. They've now turned that into a social experiment, where sometimes in a group of friends that all of us have, four or five, a circle, a clique of us that we have, sometimes it happens, I'm sure it happens with all of you as well. It's happened with me several times growing up in the West. I belong to a group that sometimes doesn't share the same ideology as I do. Not that I'm somebody great, but sometimes, you know, they have a little bit more courage to tread those dangerous waters than I do. And you're part of the clique, you're part of the boys. It's a very tribal atmosphere. It's a gang-like atmosphere. You do what your tribe does. You do what the gang does. Now, for you to sit there and tell the people, look, guys, this doesn't smell good. I don't think we should be here. You are one of six guys, seven guys, eight guys, 10 guys. You are the only one who says, let's not do this. Let's not go here. You go against the grain. You actually tell them, look, guys, I'm not going to go. It takes a very special person to do that, by the way. The fear is that you are ostracized, isolated, labeled, pushed to the side. God forbid you're kicked out of the group. So what do? You conform. You sell out. You sacrifice your values you work so hard to preserve just out of fear that you might not be accepted or labeled as somebody who might be extreme or, oh brother, we have this guy in our group. The same idea when it comes to our deen. We see a sister or brother on social media. We see them at school. There's someone else at school. We talked about mass a few nights ago, right? Different paths of our life. Sometimes we see people in Zainabia, the same person we are at school with as well. They are completely different. Not in a good way either. And you're dying to say something. I just don't know, Alana, when the right time is to say it. I'm scared she might say something, this and that. What if she stops talking to me? All the akhlaq in the world comes in this area. I don't want to be rude, man. I don't want to upset her. She's close to me. We grew up together. She's my BFF. She's everything I have. I don't want to upset it, mom. So you leave it. You turn a blind eye. You say, it's okay. Everybody has their flaws. I'll pray for you. I'll pray for her, blah, blah, blah. Somebody is, you know, God forbid, you leave from Zainabia, you drive home, and you pull to your driveway, and you see that there's a robber who's in the middle of robbing your house. None of you would say that, excuse me, Mr. Robber, hi, how are you? What was your name again? Yeah, I'm sorry, if you don't mind, that's my TV. If you could put it down, please. If you don't mind, if you need, you know, something to eat, I can give you a meal. I have an extract of baruch here. There's samosa in here. There's a piece of fried chicken in here. You can have it, please. Go ahead. All right, we have 8 already. We just need 2 of them. Please have one. If you're done, it's okay. Take your time. Have some water. All the akhlaq in the world goes out the window. You grab the guy by the neck, you throw him off your property. When Allah's house is being attacked, if you don't mind, please. I don't know, man. I don't want all the akhlaq. For some reason, applies then. Just be careful. I'm not saying for you to say, oh, you know, you're going to hell, sister, that's for sure. No, I'm not saying that. I'll get to the point, there are methods by which to do that. But first, let's get the mentality right. We are not individuals, guys. We are family. We're an ummah, we're a nation. What the person does beside me affects me directly. And for us to not say anything and let this person do what they're doing, it's difficult. We can't do it alone. Our holy prophet says this, Ya ilahi, la takilni ila nafsi tarfat aynin abada. Can you imagine this? He says to Allah, O Allah, don't leave me at my own disposal for a blink of an eye. Don't leave me by myself. Don't leave me alone for a second. Don't let my soul and my nafs guide me. Don't allow me to make my own decisions. Please, I need all the help I can get. For how long? Tarfata aynin abada. For a blink of an eye, don't leave my side. The Prophet of Allah would live 3 days without any major problems. He would cry to Allah, Allah, have you forgotten about your Habib? Have you left your Habib? He would equate struggles and hardships as an avenue of the dhikr of Allah towards him. So our first problem is that we're worried about isolation, being ostracized. What if she stops talking to me? Yes, granted, when you first approach a person, their instant reaction is very defensive. If someone, God forbid, comes to you and says, look, brother, I've been watching you do sajda. Your sajda isn't accurate. Okay? Your toes have to be a little bit this way. They're a little bit too flat, etc., etc. Our first options, who are you to sit there and tell me about my sajda? What have you read? You walk around like, you know, you have Captain Islam, you have a moon and star on your chest and a cape worn around, saving the world. Sit down. Worry about your own sajda. I'll worry about mine. That's a natural reaction. Get past that. Especially if it's someone who's close to you, in your inner circle. Sometimes they depend on you to fix them. How many times have we had individuals who discover their problems and come to you and say, how come you didn't say anything to me? How come you didn't tell me? I didn't know. Right? So the first problem we have is isolation. Second problem we have, it's a bigger problem. What if I call him out, he's going to call me. If I sit there and tell him you do 1, 2, and 3 wrong, he'll say, really? You do 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 wrong. So it's better I not hear that about myself. So I'll leave it. If I don't ruffle his feathers, he won't ruffle mine. If I don't call him out, he won't call me out. And we'll play this blindfold game, like I won't see your mistakes, and you don't see my mistakes. And we live in this la la Disneyland of a world, where everyone is happily ever after. Skipping along a yellow brick road. Because the actual problem with Amr bin Ma'ruf is us, not them. We don't want it to reflect back onto us. Oh yeah, I do this. I've been waiting for years to tell you that you do all of these things wrong. It annoys me, it's wrong, it's haram, blah, 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 this and that. And now you feel defeated, you feel down. Somebody actually exposed you. Somebody said those things to you that you've been fearing for your entire life. You know that about yourself, but when someone else tells you, it sounds different. So I'd rather not do that. I know that their reaction will be to completely reflect it back onto me. Which means for us to fix somebody else, we have to fix ourselves first. And be ready for the fact that you're right, sister, you're right, brother, I'm not perfect. You help me, I help you. Look, it's a beautiful discussion in the world of Islamic ethics. When do we have the right to go out and fix others when we ourselves need fixing? It's a great discussion. For example, when it comes to us as students in the Hawza, discussion is, when can we go out and start to do tabligh around the cities and travel different communities? My Ustad gives a very beautiful example. Please try to understand this. He says, look at the world of astronomy. He says that the earth and the planets, you guys are with me okay? Yes? I'm losing you guys. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ajil fajr.
They say that the attention span of a crowd lasts 15 minutes exactly. And after every 15 minutes, a little bit of a joke, a little bit of a salawat, a little bit of a sip of water, and it restarts for the next 15 minutes. Okay? Now, some communities are less than 15 minutes, some are a little bit more. What you are, I won't tell you. I tell others who ask me about you guys. But the 15 minutes has been a while since our last little joke, our little salawat. So inshallah, you guys are now reset, you're back with me. Inshallah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala
Muhammad.
Where was I? Thank you.
Science.
Thank you. Thank you. You passed the test. Science. Thank you. He says astronomy. Yes. He says the Earth, the planet, goes through two rotations. One rotation is that it rotates on its own axis. Correct? We are in the halat, in the state of spinning right now. In the state of its own rotation, it rotates around the sun. Correct?
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you. Astronomers in the audience, thank you for approving that message. It has its own rotation, and in that state of rotation, it rotates around the sun. When it comes to the akhlaq and the fixing of ourselves, we have our own rotation, and in the state of that rotation, we rotate around others as well. Sometimes, in order for us to fix ourselves, we should enter the journey of fixing others. It is an eye-opening experiment for us sometimes. Because right away what ends up happening is that when you show that person their mirror, they'll show you your mirror. And that's a great thing for you to happen to yourself. It's great. Sometimes we don't see it. We're blind. When they rip off our blindfold and smack us a few times, they wake up from your dream and say, this is who you are. Now, not only are we rotating, we're rotating around them as well. So there's never a moment where you can say, okay, I'm good, I'm perfect, let's go out and make others perfect as well. If that's how your mentality is, that's not what we need. So point number two, why we don't do Amr bin Ma'ruf today, it's because we're worried about our own deeds, our own record. We say the biggest fear we have of death is that death is a mulaqat with yourself. It's a meeting with yourself. I think I mentioned this before as well. When you're in this world, mashallah, you have many, many people to blame for how you are. Right? We do. I am like this, Mana, because the community does nothing for me. You know, they invite these speakers in English, they don't know what they're talking about. Canadians. When they don't find anybody else, they find this big, tall loser of a guy from Toronto. And you want us to somehow fix ourselves based on the words of this guy. Or, Mana, you know, I don't have very pious parents. They're not very religious, so this is how I am. Or Mullah, the ulama don't really understand me. Or Mullah, this, or Mullah, that, this and that. We are not united. There's a lot of friction in our community. Our adults fight a lot, so I don't go to, let's say, this community. And that, and this. This blame, that blame, this blame, that blame. When you're in the grave, there's no one to blame there. You are there, and he gives you your kitab a'mal. This is what you did in this world. Looking around, there's no Zainabiyah in your grave. There's no Alan in your grave. There's no parents in your grave. No one cares, with all due respect, what your father's name was in this world. Everything is based on what you did in this world. Our Holy Prophet says three things follow the mayyat to the qabristan, to the cemetery. Ahluhu wa maluhu wa amaluhu. The mayyat's wealth, the mayyat's family, the mayyat's amal. Two leave the cemetery, one remains. The wealth is gone. The family is long gone. It's you and it's your actions and your amal. Many times we think that my grave is right now filled with scorpions and filled with water and filled with this and that. Your box is empty, with all due respect. There's nothing in your grave right now. You will make your grave by what you take with yourself in this world. If you take the good things in this world, your grave will be a wonderful place to be in. If you don't, it won't be. This mulaqat with ourself, this meeting with ourself, is what we fear the most inside of our grave. So before that happens, have that mulaqat in this world. You should never be to a point where you are afraid somebody might expose me, or you're walking around eggshells, or you're hoping nobody will sit there and, you know, say this about me. Otherwise, that stops you from helping out others. We can't do this alone, guys. This path of spirituality needs everybody collectively together to do it. That's why this Amr bil Ma'ruf thing is wajib on us. Now, how do you do it? There are direct ways, there are indirect ways. This is really where I want all of you to understand this point. It's wajib that is wajib conditionally. If you feel, this is the key point, you get nothing from my speech, get this point. If you feel like if I talk to the sister or brother about what they're doing and try to fix them and they're going to actually get worse, then the wajib is lifted from your shoulders. Okay? And that requires you to kind of read that situation. This person's not close to you. And she doesn't wear hijab, for example. And you are a quote-unquote hijabi, as you like to call yourself. And sometimes our hijabis, our muhajjaba sisters sometimes, and with all due respect to them, not all of them, sometimes, you know, they believe themselves to be the divas of Islam, right? You see, just in brackets here, since I'm here. صلوا على محمد وعلى There is the hijab of the eyes, there's hijab of the heart, there's hijab of the tongue, there's hijab of your actions, there's hijab of your hair, there's hijab of your physical body. Okay? Hijab has many levels and aqsam to it. Okay? Unfortunately, we have lowered hijab to be a scarf on someone's head. Maybe some socks and maybe some nice lacy sleeves. But the hijab for men, we don't even know it, we don't practice it, we don't even preach it from the member. One day, someday, if my topic is hijab, we'll talk about that. There are some of our sisters who have the hijab of everything else. They just can't get themselves to cover their hair. It's hard for them. It's difficult for them. Sometimes they might even feel like, Mona, I look a little bit ugly with this hijab on. My nose is already big, it'll look 10 times bigger with the hijab on. I'm dead serious. Sometimes, you know, I don't know what my coworkers might say, what my friends might say, what my family might say, what my husband might say. I've had individuals come to me and say, Malana, I want to wear a hijab. My husband told me if you wear a hijab, I won't come 10 feet within you. I didn't marry an auntie, I married you. What do I do? And sometimes those sisters who have the hijab of the physical form down pat, everything else, there's no hijab on them. Their tongue is vicious, their heart is corrupt, everything else, but they look like a muhajjaba sister on the outside. And they use that sometimes, I'm saying sometimes, don't hate me, sometimes, to judge other sisters. I ask you, sometimes there are sisters who are on the fence, who might tomorrow start hijab. But you know, and this is not right also, but sometimes when you see the akhlaq of a muhajjaba sister, they say, you know what, thank God I'm not one of them. Be careful. Be careful. So if you know that that's going to happen, it's going to have a negative effect, don't say anything. Pray for them. But when you know this person is actually somebody who respects me and listens to me, and I have some influence on them, then you be very polite about it. Like I said, don't make them hellbound already. Tell them, look, you know, I'm just Spinoza. If you don't mind this and that, I've done some research. You might want to try this. I've been through it. It's very hard for me as well. Compromise. Have some hamdardi. Make them feel like, you know what, I'm also with you in this journey. But say something. Now, what they do after that is up to them. You have done your hujjat. I have said something, Mawlana. Now I put it in his ear. Let him not think about it. We have a lot of judgment in our communities. A lot of judgment. Allah gives you a little bit, an ounce, a pinch of tawfiq, and you think you are God's gift. You are worthy of prophethood. You look down on others. Be careful. It could be through your akhlaq, people either run from the deen or run towards the deen. Through your akhlaq, you never know. If you're considered to be pious on the outside, look at the story of the Prophet of Allah. There's a circle of around him, and he's having a little bit of a discussion. There's one spot open beside a very poor individual. A rich man comes into the circle, sits beside the poor man, and does this beside the poor man. I don't even want my clothes to touch the poor man's clothes. The Prophet of Allah stops his discussion and says, don't worry, by him touching your clothes, you won't lose your wealth. The man was so embarrassed, he says to the poor man, I really do apologize. I'm willing to offer you half my wealth. His response says what? He says, if wealth makes you like this, I'm happy where I am. If iman means that you are judgmental, walking around like you own the place, like you're God's gift, I don't want your iman. So sometimes when we are quick to do a little bit ma'ruf, when we shouldn't, don't do it. Pray for them. Do it indirectly. How to do it indirectly? Indirectly is this. For example, there's a Q&A session happening with a Mawlana. She's there, the friend that you're dying to tell, and you're there as well. Ask a question to the Mawlana such that the answer will help her. That's indirect. You're getting the point across without you coming across and cornering her. But to not have the actual obligation altogether is not right. To encourage sin is not right. I was just saying just now in Dearborn, the idea of glamorization of sin is happening today. We know people who sit there and take pictures of themselves in places they shouldn't be at, and then plaster it all over Facebook, and we as people of piety comment on the fact that, oh my God, how was it? Did you have fun? Was it really enjoyable? Next time, pick me up. Okay? That's a whole different level altogether. Imam Hussein's mission was all about Amr bin Ma'ruf. He said that every step of the way. I am there to enjoy the good, enjoy the good and forbid the evil. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Muhammad. If we are able to, as the witness of that shahadat, to take that into our life with the proper conditions and the proper methods and the proper akhlaq, then we've begun the journey of Imam Hussein. I ask my youth especially, don't fall into the trap of the Western world of the individual. Me and me and me, man, ana. That's all there is. Nobody else matters. Let's be careful of that. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
We are two nights away from Arba'in. And usually the scholars that talk about Arba'in, they talk about this relationship between a sister and